Good evening and welcome to Covenant this evening. It's a delight to see you all, and a particular delight to welcome Dr. Carl Truman to give us this second address. We live in strange days indeed, where truth is relative and people with a straight face talk about this is my truth, this is your truth, and if the two don't coincide, what's the problem? Where men cannot no longer just simply describe themselves as men and expect to be known as that, and where women are no longer just women, they may be birthing people rather than women. Strange days. I can't help but think that the person that the Lord has used, is using to challenge the foolishness of our generation is a demonstration of God's sense of humor. The person who's writing the book is Dr. True Man, or Dr. Somewhat Truthful Person, as he prefers to be known. And just even further, for those that are concerned about the Marxist takeover of the universities, an added smile, his first name being Carl, and obviously an association there with Karl Marx, because as we know, all the English are really socialists at heart. Well, enough of me. Nobody came here tonight to listen to me, and fairly certain of that. But before we go any further, let's commit our time to the Lord in prayer. Let's pray together. Our gracious God and our Heavenly Father, we do indeed find ourselves living in strange days. Days indeed that are so strange that our parents, our grandparents, would scarcely have been able to conceive of the sort of issues that we are facing. That they would have thought it extraordinary that we should be discussing things which in their day would have been impolite even to mention, and now we cannot avoid discussing. We pray, Father, that as Dr. Truman speaks to us this evening, that is granted to him that lucidity of thought and of speech, as would truly grant to us a greater understanding of the days in which we live, and with that greater understanding be better equipped to face each day. We thank thee for Dr. Truman. We bless thee for his acumen. We bless thee for providing in thy providence a year in which he could read deeply and think deeply upon these matters and provide us with tools, with weapons, in order to understand the days in which we live. May his address to us tonight further strengthen us, challenge us, and equip us. And these things, Father, we would ask in Jesus' name for his sake. Amen. Dr. Truman has written a book, and it's if I get the title right, it's the Triumph of the Self, the Modern Triumph of the Self?
Rise and Triumph.
Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. It's not, the film rights have not yet been sold, but I have got a call into Bruce Willis in the hope that he will take the starring role. Next spring, the Everyman's version is going to be published, dumbed down for as I think A.A. Milne said, for bears of lesser brain. So look for that. You can sign up now on Amazon.com for a pre-publication copy, and I would encourage you to look on Amazon for the book that's coming out in the spring, and obviously not just to boost his sales, although that won't be bad news for Carl, but also so that you might read it and pass it on to others. And having read through the one that was published and is already in print and not the easiest read, but worth the investment, is what I would say. So, Dr. Truman.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back with you all this evening. And it's funny when Ian said that the book's available on Amazon. I'm tempted to say, yeah, it's still available on Amazon. Because the introduction is by Ryan T. Anderson. Of course, Ryan has become somewhat famous this year because his book, When Harry Became Sally, on the transgender issue, is actually now not sold by Amazon. Precisely because it breaks with the predominant ideological position of our culture. I spoke a lot last night about bad news. There's a certain amount of bad news still to come this evening. One of the questions I've been asked a lot, particularly interesting enough by students in the last year, is do I think that Western civilization is going to collapse? My answer to that is it's an interesting question, and history, of course, provides us with plenty of examples of civilizations that have collapsed and come to an end. No civilization is guaranteed existence through to the end of time. Typically, the only way, though, that you can tell whether a civilization is going to pull back from the brink or collapse is it will do one thing or the other. There is no way to tell in advance what will happen. So I think the situation we face could be pretty bleak when institutions that have typically held societies together start to crumble. And when identity becomes free-floating, we are in interesting times. And when the cultural elites of our moment reverse the role of traditional cultural elites, the traditional role, of course, is the communication of values from one generation to the next. When our cultural elites see their role as the shattering of the values of the previous generation. We do live in very dangerous times, and there can be a temptation at that point to despair. I resisted, in both the longer book and the shorter book, I resisted quoting that famous section in The Lord of the Rings that every Christian pundit of the last 5 years has quoted, where Gandalf is talking to Frodo and says, "I wish that I'd been born at a different time." But these are the times in which we are born. And these are the times that we are called to respond to. And therefore, what I want to do when I start this evening is say this. I think one of the great temptations for Christians in this current moment is to despair and to lament. Now, lamentation is a hallowed biblical approach to a world that is out of joint. The Psalms are full of lamentation. I think if you look at the Psalms fully, at least a third, I think, of the Psalms contain expressions of lamentation. Some of the more notorious Psalms are Psalms of lament. Psalm 137, for example. Psalm 88, with the exception of the psalmist's use of the covenant name of God right at the start of that psalm, there would appear to be no hope. So lamentation, I think, is a perfectly legitimate thing for Christians to do, if not an imperative. But I do not think that we should stop at lamentation. The danger with lamentation is that it can render us impotent, and it can prevent us from being the faithful people of God in the situation in which we find ourselves. I was very shaped during my year in Princeton by Professor Robert George, who ran the program that I was on. He's professor of jurisprudence there, a leading conservative intellectual. And I was struck, first of all, by his very cheerful demeanor as a conservative professor at Princeton. That's not an easy place to be. And secondly, I was struck by the fact every Tuesday, the fellows, the fellowship that I was on, the fellows would have coffee with Professor George, and he would come in typically and announce the latest progressive outrage on campus or in the nation or something, some crazy thing that was going on. And I was always struck that his response was not then to sit around and moan about it for an hour. He always said, "Okay, this is the situation, so what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it?" And I was very struck that here's a man who knows the world is out of joint, who doesn't like what's going on, and yet, while many are content to sit around and be miserable and lament and despair what's going on. He wants to do something about it. And I remember a couple of years ago when the editor of First Things, Rusty Reno, contacted me asking me to be involved with him on something. Can I remember I emailed him back and I said, hey, if you're going to go down fighting, count me in. And he responded and he said, oh, I intend to fight, but I don't plan on going down at this point. So what I want to do this evening is reflect on the very bad situation we're in, but suggest some of the ways we might think about how to address this. I'd add one further caveat. I think that the way that this situation might be addressed may look different in different places. I'm going to talk particularly about how churches might think about this, and I'm pretty sure that the kind of church that I attend in rural western Pennsylvania will face the current climate, the current set of issues, in a different form to the way that you will face it in urban or suburban Chicago. So what I'll do this evening is lay out some principles and some way of thinking about things, but I'm not going to give too many direct, practical, how-to suggestions. Because I think the key thing is that we have the principles and we work out how they might apply in the particular context in which we find ourselves. The first thing I want to suggest that we need to do is we need to understand our own complicity in what has gone on. One of the most striking things, it seems to me, about the polarization of American society at the moment is the them and us mentality that is set in very deeply on both sides. And I think quite often in Christian circles that can manifest itself in a form of, I thank you, Lord, that I'm not like other men. That we tend to look at the people that we think are stealing the country from us or destroying the culture or whatever. And we tend to have at the back of our minds and perhaps within our hearts that sort of feeling of superiority in an odd way. The world's going to the dogs, but it's nothing to do with us. First thing I want to suggest is we need to realize our complicity in the culture in which we find ourselves. I talked last night about technology, and one of the things I said was, you know, I was trying to bring out was, technology in itself is neither good nor bad. We might say, it's just a thing. It's how you use that technology. It's how you use that technology that will make it good or bad. The same technology that can be used to heal people can be used to gas millions of Jews in gas chambers in Germany in the early to mid-1940s. Technology itself is just a thing. Well, one of the odd things one could think about here that in some ways is a good thing, but comes with qualifications, is religious freedom. Tocqueville, in his Democracy in America, rightly, I think, highlights that religious freedom is one of the great distinctives of the early 19th century American project compared to what he'd seen in Europe. He sees that at the heart of the American experiment lies freedom of religion. But he also observes that carries with it, to some extent, a cost. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want to live in China. I don't want to live in Iran. I love living in a country where there's religious freedom. But religious freedom brings with it a certain cost. And the cost is this. It turns the church, it tilts the church towards being a consumer good, we might say. It turns congregants into customers. Remember some years ago I read Margot Todd's wonderful book on Protestantism in early modern Scotland. Presbyterians may not be the greatest of preachers quite often, but they are the greatest of record keepers, which means they're peculiarly interesting to historians. Yeah, you can't reconstruct a sermon from the past, but you can look at minutes. And Todd's book is fascinating. There's a chapter in there on church discipline. And she goes through the rituals of church discipline. For the first offense, there's a little shelf underneath the pulpit, not quite wide enough to sit on comfortably, that the person who's committed the offense has to sit on on a Sunday. And there's powerful symbolic power. This person is under the word and facing the congregation. So there's a kind of public shame aspect to this. Second stage of discipline that's outlined is if the person doesn't repent, then on a Sunday they have to stand just outside the church door as people file in and out. And they hear the word, but they're sort of symbolically outside of the community. Third stage of church discipline is they get manacled to the walls of the church outside. Yeah, I'm sure Ian's with me on this. Yeah, if I could have manacled a few of the congregants when I was a pastor to the church wall just to teach them a lesson, I'd have done it. And you read that today, though, and I tell the students about this at Grove when I'm teaching, and the looks of horror on their face. I say, you know, the thing is, you could never do that today. Because somebody does something wrong in a congregation, and you discipline them, guess what? They don't show up the following Sunday. They jump in their automobile, and they drive to the Presbyterian church 2 miles down the road that believes exactly the same stuff, but belongs to a different denomination. And they attend there. We might even say, use more trivial examples. Congregants don't like the ties that the minister wears. By the way, I've changed my pants tonight. I was not intending to wear my red ones anyway. But I'm in blue pants tonight. Maybe some people don't like red pants, so they will go to a church where a minister wore red pants in the pulpit. So they go to another church. That's a function of freedom of religion. Freedom of religion is a good thing in that it stops the government telling you what you should worship, how you should worship, and when you should worship. But it carries with it a tilting of power towards congregants. And in our current climate, makes the church a consumer good. Maybe you've heard that phrase, church shopping. When somebody moves to a new area and they go church shopping. That's an interesting Freudian slip, I've always thought. The church is like a shop. You go to the one that you choose. Why do I mention this? It's expressive individualism. That's expressive individualism. When you leave a church because of some trivial offence that the minister has committed in a pulpit, or because you don't like something that the minister did, or something somebody else in the congregation did, suddenly the solemn vows of membership that you've taken before the congregation and before God don't count as much as the fact that you're a bit ticked off that Sunday. That's expressive individualism. I mentioned last night no-fault divorce. Another example. You know, the church has been very outspoken about gay marriage. Not so outspoken about no-fault divorce. Even though the fundamental logic and definition of marriage in both cases is very, very close. So the first thing I think we need to do is to acknowledge our complicity in what's gone on and to repent. I love that statement from Philip Reeve in his book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, where he says, nobody in the Middle Ages went to church to be made happy. They went to church to have their misery explained to them. To the extent that we now live in a world where we go to church to be made to feel good, we are complicit in that culture. How we address this is not easy. I think so. The first thing we need to do is some self-examination. I think all Christians everywhere. First thing we need to do as we think about how we respond to the culture in which we find ourselves is to examine our own hearts to see in what ways we have compromised the gospel relative to the spirit of the age. Secondly, I think we need to consciously cultivate an attitude of humility to those in the culture with whom we disagree. I think when you realize that you're actually part of the problem and not merely the solution, it makes you a little bit more forgiving of those that you typically regard as your opponents. And thirdly, I think we need to discipline ourselves to engage in some self-policing on the issue. It seems to me there is no easy solution to this. We all own cars. It is great to live in a country where there's freedom of religion. The only way we can try to combat this is by disciplining ourselves. So that's my first my first point then. Second point, and this is the sort of the typical historian's point. I've been teaching history now for, I think, 30 years when I first started as a finishing up my PhD and being a teaching assistant at the University of Aberdeen, teaching history. I've taught history the majority of years of my life. I cannot not think like a historian now. Any problem, any issue that I confront, either personally or I see in the culture, my mind immediately kicks into historian mode. Have we seen this before? Are there analogies with the past? Are there lessons we can learn, positively or negatively, from what's gone on in the past? So when we face the contemporary culture, I think, well, where do we look for the answers? And it's been interesting to me as I've observed the sort of the broader Christian world on this. Where are Christians in the broadest sense looking for answers to the current situation? Well, it's interesting that the default position, it seems to me, for Protestants, typically, is either to go back to the 18th century revivals or to the Reformation. I don't think either of those offer particularly close analogies with the situation in which we find ourselves at this point. The 18th century revivals occurred within a context where Christianity, in the broadest and weakest sense of the word, was the default position of the culture. The Reformation, of course, is, well, the Reformation is really, it's a reformation of the elites. It's the Hyhegians. It's the big men, the rulers of society who are driving the Reformation. I've noticed reading some Catholic literature on this. There's a whole Catholic movement. It's sort of the equivalent of theonomy in Protestantism that thinks, you know, if we could just go back to the 13th century. And have that sort of interesting synthesis of the thesis. I have to say, the 13th century holds no attraction for me. People died horrible deaths in the 13th century. They did in the 16th century as well. Any era that has no flush toilets, no antibiotics, and no analgesics, you don't want to live there. I joke with the students. If you're finding it too easy to get to sleep at night, dig up some old medical manuals from the Middle Ages or the early modern period. That'll put you off. Bottom line is, 13th century, we're not going back to a hand-in-glove relationship between the secular rulers and the papacy. It's just not going to happen. Where I think the real analogy for today lies is the 2nd century. It's not a perfect analogy because the 2nd century church is working against the background of a pagan culture that has never known Christianity. So there is a fundamental difference. We are increasingly working against the background of a pagan culture that has consciously repudiated Christianity. So there's a difference. But there are, I think, very significant analogies. One of the things that interests me about the 2nd century church is this. It's little understood, it's despised, and it's marginal. That's the situation in which the American church is moving at this particular point in time. One of the advantages, maybe of growing up in Scotland, certainly of growing up in England, we'll bracket ourselves together at this point. I think one of the advantages of coming from Britain to the States is I was converted in the mid-1980s in England. The church was already marginal. That was the kind of position that I cut my teeth in as a Christian. Here, I think, society is shunting the church to the margins very, very rapidly. And that's very shocking for a lot of American Christians. Takes you, though, back to the position of the 2nd century. It was despised, it was little understood, it was marginal. It was, interestingly enough, suspected of being immoral and seditious. It was suspected of being immoral for a couple of reasons. One, Christians got together to eat and drink the body and blood of their God. That sounds kind of disgusting. We have a letter from round about 112, governor of Pontus Bithynia. Gaius Plinius Secundus, Pliny the Younger, writes to the Emperor Trajan describing a Christian sect that he's broken up. And in the course of that, he describes their worshipping practices, and he says they get together to eat food. And then he adds a redundancy, but only ordinary food. And that redundancy is very interesting. It seems like a redundancy to us, but it would not have been a redundancy to Pliny, because he's working against the background of having heard that, man, this is a weird and disgusting rite in which these Christians are engaged. So they were suspected of cannibalism. They were suspected of incest, language of brother and sister. They were also, a little later on, suspected of being a highly weak and effeminate group. That's an interesting claim made by Celsus, the Roman critic of religion. It's an interesting claim because he's likely true. Because one of the things we know about the early church was it disapproved of abortion and infanticide. And if you have a culture or a community that doesn't practice something that is generally practiced by the wider culture, interesting distinctions will arise. If you have a situation, as you did in ancient Rome, where infanticide disproportionately took out the lives of young girls, then if you have a subculture within that culture that doesn't do that, you will end up with a proportionately higher number of women in that community than the wider community. So it was regarded as effeminate. It was regarded as seditious. Why was it regarded as seditious? Cry of Jesus is Lord sounds as if it's derogating from the authority of Caesar. When you track to the present day, I think we see very similar suspicions arising in society relative to the church today. It's interesting that some of the moral positions the church now holds are regarded by the wider culture as immoral. When I was at university, Christianity was regarded as ridiculous, by and large, because it didn't seem to make logical or metaphysical sense. Now it's regarded as offensive, because it holds positions that wider society regards as immoral. It's seditious. It's increasingly the case, I think, that some see being a Christian, being committed to the church, makes you something less of a good citizen. I think we're seeing the intuitions of good citizenship shifting away from conservative religion to something else. So that, I think, helps us see something of the analogy between the second century church and the church that is today. Where do we go with that? Well, I think the question then becomes, how does the second century church become so successful? The second century church becomes successful because it's a community. It's a tight-knit community where individuals look after each other. Now, if you track back to what I said last night, part of the burden of what I was saying was identity is community constructed. We tend to think that we have our own identities. We think up who we are, but actually, our identities are typically community constructed. Our identities exist, if you like, in dialogue with other people. You could do a simple thought experiment. If I were to say to Ian, what would it have been like to have been born in Japan in the 15th century to different parents speaking Japanese, even if you had the same DNA code, if you were biologically, we might say, the same person, what would it like to be you? Well, I suspect the answer would come back, I don't know, because that person wouldn't be me. I'm constituted by a network of social and cultural relationships. Identities are community constructed. What's interesting in the second century is you have very strong Christian communities and therefore very strong Christian identity. And that brings me then to reflect on the point I made a little earlier when I said this should not be a time merely for lamentation. I think we live at a time where we miss something if we don't see marginalization as an opportunity. I'm a historian. It's interesting when you look at the history of marginal and minority communities. They're fascinating to the extent that they typically become very strong communities. Think about the Jews in medieval Europe. The Jews were marginalized in medieval Europe. ultimately they become a powerful financial force because very little they could do other than borrow money. Think about 19th century England. I was born in Birmingham, which in the middle of the 19th century was the sort of the powerhouse. I suppose along with Manchester and to an extent Glasgow in Scotland, these were the powerhouses of the Industrial Revolution. What's interesting about Birmingham industry is so many of the names associated with the 19th century Industrial Revolution in Birmingham were nonconformist names. What do I mean by nonconformist? They weren't Anglican. And by law, non-Anglicans were excluded from the establishment. They couldn't vote. They couldn't go to university. They couldn't be civil servants. They couldn't teach. There was all kinds of stuff they couldn't do, but what could they do? They could make things. And so they became captains of industry. They became powerful by being a marginal community. Think, ironically, in our own day, think of the LGBTQ plus community. Step aside from any thoughts we might have about that community on sort of correlating with Christian teaching, etc., etc. Just think about it as a phenomenon. It's a remarkable political success story. Stonewall riots in the late 1960s to the situation we find ourselves in now, where Pride Month is a national celebration. You look weird if you don't have a rainbow flag or a rainbow badge on during the month of June. That's a remarkable political success story. And I would say it's rooted in the fact that it's a very strong community. Second century church is a good example of that. Now, how do we do that? I think community looks probably different in different places. I live in Western Pennsylvania. Community is going to look very different in Western Pennsylvania to what it does in suburban Chicago. But there are certain basic elements, I think, of Christian community anywhere. Central, of course, is the Sunday worship service. Gathering together, praying, singing God's praise, hearing the word read and preached, celebrating baptism and the Lord's Supper, giving materially to the church work. These are the things that all Christians should do anyway. Might sound very trite, but I think a large part of the church's witness to the world is simply being the church in worship. I've always been a bit uncomfortable with the language of the church transforming the culture, because in my mind, the church is a culture. I've always been a little uncomfortable with the language of culture war as well. Not that the Bible doesn't use martial language. I'm not saying that's illegitimate language to use at all. But I find a more helpful language is that of cultural protest. The church is an oasis of cultural protest. How do we protest the outside culture? By being an alternative culture that witnesses to the shortcomings of that which is outside. And if what I said last night was correct, that we're at a time of a rising new notion of self and identity, and we're seeing the crumbling of traditional institutions by which one would find external markers for one's identity, and if human beings still intuitively consider themselves to be free but want to belong, people are going to be looking for strong communities to which they can belong. This could be a great opportunity for us. Certainly hinted at in the second century literature that this was the church's strategy. If you read the work of the Greek apologists, for example, Justin Martyr, much of Justin's work is rooted in emphasizing to the secular authorities that Christians make good citizens to the extent that they are able to be good citizens. They didn't spend their time denouncing the evils of the emperor and his court. And the emperors could be pretty evil in the second century. What they did was they spent their time essentially saying, leave us alone, we will be good citizens, and we will be faithful communities. There are limits to what they could do to participate in civic life, of course, in the second century. If asked to sacrifice to Caesar or to another god, they had to refuse. But other than such demands, they were able to be good citizens and model an alternative community within the broader community of the ancient world. The second century offers a vision of the church in a hostile culture that calls on the church to be the church and on Christians to be constructive members of the wider society in which they are placed. Some might say that sounds like defeatism or withdrawal. Well, as I jokingly say to the students at college, second century is followed by the third century. And the third century is followed by the fourth century. And by the time we get to the fourth century, the church is in a pretty strong and powerful cultural position. I think too often we tend to think short term. Is this going to give me instant results next week or during my lifetime? I think the way we need to think at the moment is we're building for two or three generations down the line. I often quote this, but Patek Philippe watches, which have an entry-level price of about $100,000, I think. I don't own one. I've owned houses that are worth less than a Patek Philippe watch. But because they're so expensive, they have this wonderful byline. And the byline is, you never really own a Patek Philippe. You merely look after it for the next generation. I think that's good mentality. Second point, teach the whole counsel of God. One of the temptations at a time of tremendous flux and change is to fixate upon immediate challenges. It's not a bad thing to prioritize the immediate problems that the church faces on occasion. Indulgences is the major problem in 1517. I don't think Luther makes an error by zeroing in on that problem in 1517. But there is a danger that we can become so preoccupied with the immediate threats, we miss the broader picture. And I think in times when there seem to be so many pressing issues coming at us so fast from so many different directions, there's a temptation to play a kind of whack-a-mole game where we're constantly trying to address the thing that suddenly became an issue early this morning or yesterday afternoon. I think it's important that the chaotic nature of our times does not become an excuse for abandoning the church's task of teaching the whole counsel of God. Indeed, if you think that Christian truth sort of hangs together as a whole, it becomes even more important to teach the whole counsel of God so that we have a broad framework to respond to particularities and particular issues. It's where I think creeds and confessions are very, very useful, because the very fact that they've lasted through time, and time is a great corroder of irrelevance and fluff, gives us something of a perennial framework for seeing the overall structure of the faith as a whole. Some might respond and say, yes, but do these documents not have limited usefulness today, given the fact that we have very specific issues arising in our culture? The transgender question, for example, is not addressed by the Westminster Confession of Faith directly, I would say. But I would say if you have a good grasp of the system of doctrine that the Westminster Confession of Faith expresses, you have a good foundation for thinking through even novel questions as they arise within your church context. So that's the second thing. Third thing. Talked a lot yesterday about the social imaginary, Charles Taylor's concept, that I think captures nicely the way most people think about the world. In fact, all of us think about the world to some extent. And that's saying we do not think about the world in terms of going back to first principles. We tend to imagine the world is a certain way. And that's how we read the world, that's how we interact with the world, it's how we interact with each other. It's what makes social interaction possible. Well, precisely because the social imaginary connects with what one might call the imagination, it's not something that can be taught in a direct propositional manner. You can't go to a lecture and have your imagination changed. It's more nebulous than that. How do we do that? Well, I would say one of the ways we do that is by having our intuition shaped through biblical worship. Where do we find ourselves as Christians in a situation where we're not simply hearing a lecture like you are tonight, but one might say the whole person is being engaged in a way that shapes intuitions? I think that occurs in worship. Question was raised last night about, well, so are emotions, or is that inner space, is it entirely wrong? Well, no. we do have an inner space. The question is how we understand, how we intuit that inner space. Augustine's autobiography, The Confessions, is one of the classics of Christian literature. The book is preoccupied with Augustine's inner life. What's interesting, however, is that Augustine's Confessions, we might say, it moves inwards psychologically only in order to move outwards towards God. One of the most remarkable things about the Confessions, and this is a sort of revolutionary literary move, is that Augustine takes a pagan genre of literature, and that's a book written that begins as a prayer to a pagan god, and he does it better than any pagan has ever done it. He revolutionizes the genre by turning the whole book into an extended prayer and doing it to the Christian God. And that dynamic of introspection connected to praise is a fascinating one. And it's what makes the Confessions so great. The danger with the world of expressive individualism is we move inwards in order to wallow in self-pity. Augustine's paradigm is we move inwards only in order to move outwards towards God. And that, incidentally, is the pattern you often find in many of the Psalms. Psalm 88 is something of an exception. But generally speaking, the lamentations of the Psalms are the psalmist looks around, despairs of the world, looks into his heart, despairs, and then moves out looking towards God in worship. For the church to grasp this truth and shape our psychological intuitions in a biblical way, she needs, I think, to think long and hard about one of the central formative acts of Christian worship, singing. It's no coincidence that the Psalter is the central book of praise within the Bible. And the Psalms, of course, we can't appreciate them today in quite the way they would have been appreciated then, because they're written in poetry. Poetry is very difficult to translate from one language to the next. Something is lost because in poetry the form is very important as well as the content. And they were also to be sung. Say to the students, you know, sometimes when you look at cultures, often the things that are most important in a culture are expressed in corporate song and music. Think of the African-American experience. African-American spiritual tradition, the suffering of a people, cannot be expressed there just by writing prose. It's expressed through poetry connected to music. Alan's not here tonight, I don't think, but Alan Strange, big Wagner fan, at the end of Wagner's opera The Valkyrie, end of Act 3, there's this amazing scene where Wotan, king of the gods, he's been betrayed by his daughter Brunhilde. And it's an interesting scene because he has to punish her. She's defied him as king of the gods, so she needs to be punished. She's his daughter, so he feels deep personal betrayal. But he also loves her because she's his daughter. So he feels love towards her, and he feels heartbreak at what he's got to do. He's going to kiss her, remove her divinity from her, and she's going to fall asleep on a bed which is then going to be surrounded by fire until a great hero will arise to rescue her. And the question, of course, for a dramatist is, how do you express anger, love, heartbreak, disappointment? How do you express all of those things? Can't do it through plain prose. What Wagner does, of course, is he combines dramatic action, poetry, and music. And when you listen to or you watch that scene, it's very powerful. It's, we might say, transformative, because those three things are involved. I'm convinced that what we sing in church and how we sing it is very, very important to how we think as Christians. If anything shapes our intuitions, it's worship. And at the heart of worship is that combination of poetry and music that is what we sing. And that's not, by the way, a pop at contemporary worship or an advocating of traditional worship or anything. Again, these things, music particularly, can be very culturally specific. What music means can be very specific to a culture. But it's to say, I think we need to take the singing in our church very, very seriously. Because if the way we intuit the world, the way we imagine the world involves the whole person, then that which grips the whole person is very significant. And there is nothing in the worship service that grips the whole person like the combination of ideas, poetry and music that is what we sing. Think about it. What were the Psalms doing? They were shaping the way the Israelites imagined the world. They were shaping the way the Israelites related to their experience. It is no coincidence that they are poetry set to music. I also alluded last night, my next point would be natural law and theology of the body. What do I mean by natural law? Natural law is the idea that the world in which we live is not simply indifferent stuff, but has a certain structure. Our bodies in particular have significance. We connect to others through our bodies. There is a fascinating amicus brief being filed this week by, I think, 500 women athletes against the Dobbs case, which is the case, the abortion case arising from Mississippi. It's going to the Supreme Court. And what's fascinating about this brief by the 500 female athletes is how they think about their bodies. The way they talk about their bodies is as instruments. Instruments. Something they use to achieve something. Now, if you do that once, you know, I might say, I keep my body fit in order to feel well. If you do that once, we could say it's a figure of speech. When you do it repeatedly, page after page after page, it tells you something about how we now think of our bodies. Our bodies have become something we inhabit rather than something we are. Thomas Aquinas, the 13th century theologian, has an interesting discussion of the resurrection. He says, when you die, you go straight away to be with God. But then he goes on and says, but it isn't you. Makes you sit up and take notice of that point. Well, if it isn't me, if I've gone to be with God, why isn't it me? And Aquinas comes and he says, because you are body and soul. You are not just soul. Your body is not something you inhabit. It is you. Our bodies have a shape and a structure. They are not mere stuff for us to use as instruments to achieve whatever we want to achieve. They're an integral part of us. I can't go, for example, onto the top of the Empire State Building, jump off and expect to survive. My body is not an instrument. My body means I can't fly under my own strength. What natural law does is it points to what we might say the natural nature of the human body and draws conclusions from that. I said last night, Rousseau's famous statement, man is born free and everywhere is in chains. That's complete nonsense. It grips the imagination. People have built whole societies essentially on that anthropology, but it's nonsense. Human beings of all creatures on the face of the earth are born not in a state of freedom, but in a state of utter dependency. And throughout life, we become a little more free, and then as we get older, we descend back into being more dependent. What natural law does is it takes, we might say, the natural human condition and draws certain conclusions from that. When you think about the issues that I raised in my book and I touched on last night, when you think about identity, when you think about sex, natural law is of obvious help here. Don't want to be too explicit, but male and female bodies are made to fit together in some ways and not in others. You don't have to take my word for that. You can go to government health websites and look at the life expectancy and the physical damage, the transmission of diseases that are rife among communities that use human bodies sexually in certain ways. We might say it's a natural fact. One response, of course, in the church is, well, we can't use natural law arguments because people are sinful and won't believe them anyway. I want to say, maybe. But I would add to that, I'm not using natural law arguments necessarily to convince somebody outside of the correctness of my position. I want to use natural law arguments within the church to persuade Christians that the positions we hold on certain things make sense. That the Bible, the church, teaches what it teaches, not simply because God is mean and doesn't want certain people to be fulfilled, but because that actually reflects the best way to flourish in the world in which we find ourselves living. Finally then, to draw to a close, I want to come back to where I started and say, lamentation. Lamentation should not be the end of our reflection. And I would pose it in this way. We should neither be optimists, nor should we despair. They are equal and equally dangerous, I think, temptations. To despair is to fall into the temptation to disregard the promise that the church will win in the end. To be optimistic, I think, is simply to prepare the stage now for deeper despair later. And both despair and optimism feed inaction. One from a sense of impotence, the other out of naivety. I was very struck last year in conversation with my friend, the Eastern Orthodox conservative journalist, Rod Dreher. And I pulled his leg and I said, you know, every day at 3 o'clock, Rod, I'm feeling fine, and then I get your email blast and I know that I'm going to be depressed because you're such a pessimist. And his comment was, he said, I'm not a pessimist. He said, but nor am I an optimist. He said, I'm hopeful. And I said, well, okay, explain that to me. And he said this, well, Christian hope is realistic. It understands this world as a veil of tears. It realizes that all life, death, does end. It realizes that this world is not the Christian's ultimate home, and so we should not expect it to provide us with ultimate home comforts. But it is to say that all the sufferings and setbacks in this world will ultimately be subverted for a greater good. Struck by that passage of Paul in 2 Corinthians, when he's gone through that litany of his suffering in ministry, and then he turns around and says, but this light momentary affliction is preparing me for an eternal weight of glory that is to come. That's hope. And that's where I want to end this lecture this evening. I want to say, yeah, these are difficult times. There's a lot of chaos in our world. A lot of institutions that we relied upon are crumbling before our eyes. A notion of identity has arisen that is remarkably subjective and unstable. The political revolutions that we see in our culture are consistently devouring their own. We live in a world of continual change and turmoil, but we still have the promises. We need to do our bit. I think we need to be a strong and loving community. I think we need to continue teaching the whole counsel of God. I think we need to worship in a manner that shapes the intuitions of ourselves and of the rising generation in an appropriate way. And I think we need to think pedagogically about the role of things like natural law and the theology of the body in talking to young people and to others about some of the most pressing issues of our day. But above all, I think, we need to retain hope. God is still sovereign. The promises still count. Neither despair nor optimism, but hope. That, I think, is the way for the future. Thanks very much.
Yesterday evening, we had a brief question and answer time, and we'll do the same again tonight. We'll have three questions, and then there'll be an opportunity if you want to just have a word with Dr. Truman, to try and involve him after the conclusion of the meeting. So, first question, anyone? Yes.
In your book, Rise and Triumph, you introduce us to Charles Taylor and Philip Wright. I hadn't known them before, but you build upon the work that they did. If you were able to interact with them today and call it to me about your book, what might they say about your conclusions?
Charles Taylor is an interesting character. Charles Taylor is, he's one of those guys who always tries to find the good in everything. So I suspect he would look at my book and say, at the end of the day, you paint a rather bleak picture. And I think Taylor would press me on the, I'm not sure that we should use the language of bleakness about what's going on. It's just different. It's helpful to understand it, but it's neither better nor worse than what has gone before. I think that's where he would go with that. Philip Reeve, the prophet of the coming darkness, as he was known, he might almost take the opposite case. I think he might say to me, you know, your plea for Christian community, it's too late. We don't have the capital even to do that. That we are all so immersed in expressive individualism and in a sense of our own freedom and autonomy that the construction of any kind of community is likely impossible at this point. So I suspect they would go in different directions on that. One of the things that Reef doesn't deal with, because he died in 2006, whether Taylor will ever deal with this, I don't know, but one of the most pressing issues that emerged just in the last couple of years has been, I mentioned last night, social acceleration. The fact that we now have technological developments occurring at a speed that we are not able to assimilate them. And that, I think, puts us in a culturally very dangerous position. And I've become aware recently of that there are even members of the scientific community who hold no religious convictions at all, who seriously question whether advanced technology will make civilization utterly unsustainable in the long run, because technology will simply sweep all before it. And the non-technological things that make society possible, simple human interaction, for example, will be overwhelmed or eliminated by this. One of the striking things I think about today is how disembodied so much engagement is. And I think that's not unrelated to the rising temperature and polarization in society. Because if you have to interact with somebody face to face, generally speaking, the tendency is towards cooling things down. If all you ever do is bash people on Twitter, Twitter has none of the typical human factors. There's a famous letter that George Orwell writes to Stephen Spender, the English poet and playwright. Orwell had been very critical of Spender, and Spender noticed that Orwell suddenly started to be much more pleasant towards him in print, and he writes and asks Orwell, why is this the case? And George Orwell responds by saying, because I met you at a party. And then he says, once you've stared into a man's eyes, you know he's a fellow human. And it becomes so much more difficult to be hard about him. And I noticed that over the last couple of years, for some years, I got a lot of nasty hate mail on email. There's actually still one guy who sends me a hard copy letter every month. There it is, it arrives, trashing me, telling me what a wicked person I am. He thinks I'm too left-wing, by the way, which is kind of amusing, but given the current circumstances. But I've noticed in the last 12 to 18 months, I don't get hate mail anymore. I get a lot of people bashing me on Twitter. And it strikes me that's interesting, because even an email involved a smidgen of personal courage. The person's got to contact you directly and take the risk of you firing back at them. It takes no courage to do it on Twitter, particularly under a pseudonym on Twitter. It's a very cowardly way of engaging somebody. But it's also a way of engaging somebody that involves none of the constructive things that come out of personal interaction. And I think when you think about what a lot of young women in this country are going through, reading Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, she makes the point that when she was a young girl in the late 70s, early 80s, yeah, she had the usual obsessions about body image, etc., etc. But the number of people who commented on her body image were a couple of dozen people, and she knew them all. And she saw them all. And they toned down what they said precisely because she saw them all. Now, your average young girl she's pray for any, you know, sticks up a picture on Instagram, just celebrating something, being happy. Everybody can pile on and tell her how ugly and dysfunctional, etc., etc., she is. And that, I think, plays into the terrible teenage anxiety and depression we now have. So I think the thing that neither Reith nor Taylor comments on, but which is going to be so important for us just as a civilization in the next 10, 15 years, is we have no idea where this disembodied engagement is taking us. And I don't think it's taking us anywhere good.
Last question.
Yes. Society so clearly is going against natural law, but in some ways, as a church, we just need to wait and see the body scratching on the rocks and go help people, because
yeah.
There's got to be some psychological and emotional wrecks out there.
Yeah.
It has to be, because
yeah, I think
the girls that are getting double mastectomies now, they have sterilized themselves
yeah.
with the puberty blocker. Surely
yeah.
in 20 years, we're going to have these people showing up at our doorsteps. That's
just it's already happening. Transitioning back is becoming a... Oh, sorry, the question is, can I paraphrase it essentially? Can we constantly fight nature and expect to get away with it? Does that sort of summarize it? And I would say no. And I think particularly on the trans issue, it's interesting. Trans is very trendy at the moment. There is a case in Britain that is making its way up through the courts of a young girl who transitioned. And it didn't solve any, surprise, it did not solve any of her problems. Because the problem was not that she was a boy trapped in a woman's body. Her problem was something else. And basically mistreated, we would say. Nature's going to have the last say. Bottom line is you die. You can do what the heck you like to your body. But you're going to die. Your body is going to have authority over your identity at some point. And I think we will see this, particularly with the trans movement, that you can believe that you can mess with reality, but reality will bite back. The reason why I don't think we should just sit back and watch this happen is innocent people are getting hurt by this. When my wife is reading a story to me from the internet the other day, some woman celebrating that her her toddler child is trans because she wants a boy's haircut. I think this is loony land. That's child abuse. And your three-year-old says to you, who am I? And you say, I don't know. Think it up for yourself. I don't want to imperiously impose my vision of who you are on you. That's child abuse. And I think in years to come, we're going to see, and we're already seeing it starting, people are going to get sued. I think children who are damaged because their parents didn't parent them, they're going to sue the doctors, they're going to sue the insurance companies, and I hope they sue their parents. And this is America. And when it starts costing insurance companies money, public morality will change very quickly. The tragedy is that so many lives will be destroyed. I saw some silly professor of queer studies somewhere, a video online the other week saying, you know, why shouldn't we allow 15, 16-year-olds? Let me make a distinction here. If you're an adult and you want to transition, I don't want to stand in your way. If you want to pay for it, that's fine. I'm concerned about kids. And this person was making the case, well, we allow 15, 16-year-old kids to make life-changing decisions all the time. Why not gender? Well, a 16-year-old kid could well make a disastrous choice of college. But probably in 20 years' time, they're going to rectify that. 15-year-old kid who has her breasts removed and her ovaries removed and her body pumped full of hormones, that does permanent damage. At 14 or 15, she is deciding that she never wants to have children. I don't know about you, but at age 14 or 15, I should not have been trusted with choosing a meal for somebody else. You know, 14 and 15-year-olds are incapable. Physiologically, the brain has not fully developed till 25. So, When we come to the trans thing, I do want to make a distinction perhaps I haven't made in my ditch last night. If you're an adult and you want to transition, fine. I think you're wrong, and I don't think you're going to solve the problem, and I think you're going to suffer an awful lot of pain, mental and physical, because of this. But it's a free country, and I don't think I have the right to stop you doing it. But when it comes to prepubescent children being given puberty blockers, I have an interest in that. And so I know this is not what you're saying in your question, but I'm saying I don't think we should just sit back and let this happen. We need to speak up for the innocent. We need to speak up for the people who are being harmed and damaged by this. I'm a Reformation historian. I got galvanized into this stuff because of the damage I realized it was going to do to kids. And I have the privileged position of working at a college where I can say what I say and not be fired. At least at the moment, and it looks like I'll be good for retirement, the way things are going. And if people like me aren't prepared to speak up, how can we expect those who are in places where they could really jeopardize their livelihoods? How can we expect them to speak up? But I don't think we should sit passively by. I do think we need to speak up for the innocent on this.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Sherman, for giving us such an illuminating and lucid account. Lots more questions that we could ask, but a Saturday evening, which means tomorrow is a Sabbath day, and we should be bright and early for the worship of the Triune God, and not arriving too late and too worn out intellectually. So we'll close now, and if you want to come forward and just talk a little while, please feel free, and thank you very much for coming.